Good morning, and welcome to the session on Copyright Network Environments. My name is Pam Samuelson. I'm going to be the moderator of our session today. I'll be making a few introductory remarks and introducing our speakers, following which I will ask each of the speakers to give a kind of 5-minute synopsis of the issues that are of greatest interest and concern to them. And then my plan is that I will ask some questions and then get some discussion going among the four of us. And then without waiting for a really long time, I want to give you in the audience a chance to raise issues of concern to you. So sort of midway through the program, then I will take questions from the floor so that we can make sure that this particular session responds to the issues of concern to people in the audience. And then we may sort of take a few comments, questions, statements by people in the audience, and then go back to some more questions from me, or at least discussion among the four of us, and then go open it again to questions. And I hope that will be a way for us to both be informative and also to be responsive to your interests. For the past couple of hundred years, copyright and free expression values have been thought to be largely congruent with one another. The idea is that more authors are encouraged to create expressive works and to be willing to share them with the public by virtue of the exclusive right that copyright law gives authors to protect against unauthorized commercial exploitations of their works. Consequently, we get a lot more works created, a lot more works disseminated, and that essentially fosters knowledge and other free expression values. And because copyright law only protects the expression of an author, it doesn't protect ideas. The idea is the free flow of information is not really interfered with, because all another author has to do is use his or her own new words to express the same ideas in order to avoid infringement. And even sometimes it's okay to take little portions of an existing work if you want to criticize or comment on it. And so the Supreme Court, in a case in the United States a couple of years ago, decided that it was okay, or at least that it was possible, for two live crew to raise a fair use defense when they engaged in a parody of Roy Orbison's song Pretty Woman, even though the owners of the copyright were not very happy about that. So if we have this long history of a kind of congruence between copyright and free expression values, it's important to realize that that wasn't always so, that there was a time in which copyright policy and censorship, in fact, were married rather than copyright and free expression. There was a time when, in order to print works, you had to have a license. In order to get your work printed, you had to have a licensed printer to do it, and there was an effort by the Crown essentially to make a deal with printers that they wouldn't print seditious and heretical material. And so there was then a long period of time in which copyright and censorship were really congruent policies, not copyright and free expression. And one of the issues that I hope we'll discuss today is whether or not we're on the cusp of a third era in which it's not clear at the moment whether we have copyright and free expression that will go together, or copyright and suppression of expression which will go together. And it seems to me that that's a set of issues which is of concern to this community as well as to the public at large. In the process of trying to organize this particular session, I decided that I would follow two principles that Hal Abelson had given us. One is to generate more light than heat on this controversial subject, and therefore I didn't invite some of the people who have been involved in some of the copyright wars, so to speak. I also wanted to follow the principle of not taking too U.S.-centric a view of things, and so, in fact, my panel has a majority of speakers who are not U.S. speakers. So let me sort of briefly introduce them, and then I'll give them a chance to make their first opening statements. Chris Barlas at the far end of the table is an author and someone who makes his living off writings and the like. He's also affiliated with the UK Authors Licensing and Collecting Society, so that's another kind of hat that he wears. A third hat that he wears is working with the Imprimatur project, which has been set up in Europe by Esprit, and in connection with that he's been involved in a lot of the discussions on an international scale about how we can make copyright work in the digital environment. The second person, or the person in the middle here, is Dr. Bernd Hogenholz, who is a copyright scholar affiliated with the Information Law Institute at the University of Amsterdam. He is also a practitioner of copyright law and represents the industries that are affected by copyright law. He is also an advisor from time to time of the European Commission on digital copyright and other kinds of intellectual property issues, so I think he knows the European policy environment very well. Immediately to my right is David Post, who's a visiting professor at Georgetown Law School, whose expertise is both in constitutional law and in intellectual property law. He is also the co-founder of the Cyberspace Law Institute, which is looking to try to find practical solutions to some of these complex legal problems, some of which may be technological in nature and some of which may be new kinds of institutions, such as a virtual magistrate project that's gotten started to kind of resolve some disputes on the net. So with that introduction, then why don't you, David, give us your thoughts.
Okay. Thanks, Ben. Let's see, 5 minutes. I wanted to start by, I want to focus my remarks on some disputes that most of you are probably familiar with involving the Church of Scientology and some dissident church members. Most of you probably know the general outline of these disputes. I can go through it very quickly. The Alt-Religion Scientology news group on Usenet, which was formed, I think, in 1991, if I'm not mistaken, has been the focus of vigorous discussion, most of which is highly critical of the Scientologists and their teachings and techniques. Several years ago, a number of postings appeared on ARS, some of which were posted anonymously, containing text attached to them, the text of documents that the Scientologists at least claim were copyrighted writings of L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, and that additional, in addition to being copyrighted material, contained trade secrets. These are documents that, again, the Scientologists claim they do not show generally to people unless they have gone through rigorous training within the church. The Scientologists have instituted a number of highly publicized lawsuits in Denver, San Jose, Alexandria, Virginia, Amsterdam, against both the individuals responsible for these postings and in several cases against the service providers who were providing internet access for those individuals. They also, as some of you know, were successful in obtaining a warrant in Finland, I believe the only one thus far, against Johan Helsingius, the owner and operator of the Anon Penet Phi anonymous remailer. They've been, I think it is fair to say, very aggressive as they see it, protecting their copyright interests. I think the Scientology cases illustrate a number of very interesting and very important themes. I want to focus on two of them. One is obvious, and one I think may be less obvious. Let me start with the obvious one, obviously. The Scientology disputes remind us, as Pam, I think, has reminded us, that copyright has a cost. It's relatively easy to see the benefits of a strong copyright regime. The standard analysis, and I think the correct analysis, is that copyright stimulates creative activity. Giving people a property right in their expressive creations gives them an incentive to create more creative expression. I generally ask my students, after having gone through that in a little more detail, well, if that's the case, you know, why not make copyright just stronger and stronger and stronger? I mean, if it gives us more creative, if the stronger copyright is, the more creative expression we get, let's have more copyright, and we'll have more creative expression and more books and music and songs, et cetera. And the answer, of course, is, as the Church of Scientology cases illustrate, that while stronger copyright protection may indeed stimulate the creation of new works, it also reduces the ability of people to make use of information that has already been created. So it may stimulate, if you will, L. Ron Hubbard to write new books, but it simultaneously reduces the ability of others, of third parties, to make use of that information in some way, to quote it, to pass it on to others, and to build upon it. Copyright law has always had this tension. It's inherent. It's as true in the print medium or with respect to musical recordings as it is on the net. What I think is different, and one of the things I think we'll explore here, is that now in the digital networked age, if you will, the scope of activities to which this principle, this tension applies, is so much broader because so much of what happens on the net is potentially subject to copyright claims. When we're all standing out in the hallway talking to each other about this, that, and the other, those conversations, we're not thinking, of course, about copyright law at all. It is irrelevant, in fact, to those discussions about whether or not what we're saying is copyrighted and whether I can repeat what I just heard. It doesn't come up. But when we have those same conversations on the net, copyright law suddenly rears its head and potential copyright claims are suddenly in our face, as it were. I think this is a consequence partially of the point that was made yesterday in the media session about the fact that we're all publishers, if you will. We are all creating copyrighted expression or potentially copyrighted expression in this new age. So we have to think a little bit. So suddenly this copyright tension and the copyright balance becomes of concern to a much wider audience. I think there are clearly more people thinking about copyright law now, concerned about copyright law, than at any previous time in history for that reason. So that's the obvious point. We're in a copyright-dominated or potentially copyright-dominated environment. And that copyright, and there are costs to increasing copyright protection. The second point is, as I said, less obvious and I think more controversial. I'm struck, as I was sitting here yesterday, by the near consensus, I think, to the extent that this group can have a consensus about anything. It seems to be that members of Congress, at least, I guess the picture of Senator Burns is no longer up. Members of Congress are, generally speaking, ill-equipped to legislate for the net, at least currently, because of their lack of knowledge about the net's unique characteristics. I think it was Jill yesterday, in yesterday's evening session, who said, during the debate about the Communications Decency Act, how many of the senators and congressmen were sort of advertising the fact that they didn't know how to use their VCRs and it was all a great mystery to them and isn't that funny and all of that. I take that one step further and say that there are some unique features of this medium of the net that have to be taken into account in designing a functioning copyright law for the net. And that in a sense the principle of self-determination requires us to look in the first instance not to Congress, and not to the French National Assembly, and not to the Israeli Knesset, and not to the Japanese Diet, for the rules that will best effectuate this difficult copyright balance, but to the online communities themselves. And a brief example of what I mean by the uniqueness, the unique characteristics of the net that are relevant, is the fundamental notion of copying itself. In the real world, or I hate the phrase real world because it makes it sound like the net is not the real world. One of my students came up with the name the slow world, which I sort of like. In the slow world, if you reproduce in tangible form a copyrighted work, you have infringed. That's why they call it the copyright. It's about copying. But I think those who spend time on the net instinctively know that every act of reproducing information cannot be an infringing act, because reproducing information is what the net is all about. It will grind to a halt without the capability of reproducing information. The ability to reproduce information stands behind everything we do, from sending mail to browsing on the web to downloading files, etc. And if we simple-mindedly map this notion of reproduction equals a copyright claim, as the administration, I'm sorry to say, seems to want to do, then we have instantaneously privatized this domain. We've suddenly made everything that happens on the net subject to private claims, private property claims. And I think this calls for sort of a double-edged strategy. One is, for those of us who spend time on the net and are concerned about its development, we need to educate legislators and judges about the special and unique characteristics of this medium, but I think that's not enough. I think we need to get serious about this notion of self-determination, about ways to uncover the expectations of people who spend time on the net about copying and copyright, and the scope of permissible copying, and to think about new rules and new ways to implement those rules in online communities. And I'll talk a little bit as the discussion goes about some of the ways in which the technology, software as law, the code itself, can play a part in designing the new rules. Let me finish by coming back to the Church of Scientology. Many people, I suspect, in this room find these cases easy. Easy in the sense that they see the Scientologists as using, litigation as a sword, as attempting to suppress dissent, and to squash free expression on the net. I don't think they are that easy. And I don't think they are that easy because the Scientologists did not voluntarily enter the online community. Their documents were smuggled across the border. And I think we're going to have to think about how we deal with those as separate from documents that are created online and that were created in this environment to take advantage of the special characteristics of this environment. If we expect the net's rules to be taken seriously, if we expect our rules to be taken seriously and to be given respect by legislators and judges, it seems to me it's incumbent upon us to respect the legitimate interests of people who have not chosen to be subject to those rules. And I think that plays out in copyright as well as in other domains of the law, and we can talk about more of that in the discussion.
Great. Thank you. Clearly there's a major tension between copyright and freedom of expression, the issue we are talking about this morning, even though copyright is generally described as an engine of free expression. At least that's what the handbooks always say. We've never really measured that, by the way. Maybe we can, maybe we can't, I don't know. Something perhaps for the economists of law. But anyway, there's a tension, and we have to balance that tension. And let's look at the way copyright has traditionally dealt with that tension. How has copyright, until the advent of the Internet, achieve that balance, that necessary balance between copyright and freedom of expression? Well, by a number of ways. Many of these ways not expressly identified as freedom of expression machines, but they're there anyway in the system. First of all, in the way we define the work of authorship, protected information, copyright does not protect all information per se, not the ideas Pam Samuelson mentioned, not the facts, not the theories, only creative expression, original works of authorship. That's one important concession towards freedom of expression. Second one, in the scope of the rights that are protected under copyright. Copyright protects acts of exploitation of protected information. Copyright protects broadcasting and publishing and electronic publishing and all kinds of commercial forms of exploitation, but copyright traditionally does not protect any acts of usage. Individual usage of copyright protected works has always been exempt from copyright protection. Very important means of protecting the individual sphere of the user, very important means of protecting the freedom of expression and information of the information society. Third, the scope of copyright exemptions. Copyright has exemptions in many ways. Even the protected rights have their limits in certain specified limitations and exceptions. In the United States, you have a very broad fair use concept, which is a very flexible instrument, it turns out, in the internet world and outside the internet world as well. In Europe, we have specific limitations detailing in media-specific means what in certain circumstances does not constitute a restricted act. I refer as a rather gruesome example to the set of the library privileges in the United Kingdom Copyright Act. If you ever understand the library privileges, you are privileged indeed. I always say I'd rather pay a license than read the library privileges. Fourth, the way we interpret liability. Copyright liability does not mean that everybody providing copyright protected information in any way is necessarily liable. And that brings us, of course, to the Church of Scientology. Church of Scientology, I think we should applaud them in a way for raising these important issues in quite an early stage of development of the Internet. I think we should applaud them for allocating so many substantial sums extracted from their poor followers to these rather urgent and important discussions. Two lawyers, by the way, as well. By the way, in doing so, they really have done a tremendous disservice to the copyright industries. If I were a copyright industry, I would have paid the Church of Scientology millions of dollars not to instigate all these proceedings, but because the way I look at these cases is that the prime reason why they have lost most of them until now, practically all, by the way, not only in the U.S. but in Europe as well, is that they are the Church of Scientology. And not because service providers are never liable or will never become liable in the digital future. If we look at a recent decision by the president of the District Court of The Hague, which I have here for people that are interested. By the way, it's on the net, so why should you need a copy? If we look at that decision, it's a very ambiguous one, and it's really reasoned toward denying the Church of Scientology its claims, but not in any way in legally from a sound point of view. Okay, that brings me back to copyright and freedom of expression. David Post has already said a lot about the scope of protected rights. I think in achieving the necessary balance on the internet between copyright and freedom of expression, looking at the scope of protected rights, looking at the way they work out on the internet is vital. This is especially vital in those countries that work with media-specific protected rights. Many of the protected rights are patterned after existing modes of exportation. Exportation in book form, theatrical, exhibition, broadcasting, cable, etc., etc. Many of these rights do not reckon with the new mode of exploitation of protected works on the internet, in the internet environment. We have learned yesterday, and we knew it already before that, that the internet presents quite a different way of communicating works, and I think copyright should take that into account. What we should not see happen, and we're seeing this already quite some time now, is that is what courts and legislators in many countries are currently doing, trying to apply these old media notions to the new environment. And this is especially true and worrisome, and I repeat what David Post already has said in that respect, in respect of the reproduction right. The reproduction right is really being abused to make copyright turn into a monster on the internet. Maybe that's because courts and legislators and lobbyists don't understand the internet. In my opinion, it's because they don't want to understand, because they have this reproduction right, which is very strongly formulated, which is core of copyright in many legislations, and they see copies flying around the internet, trillions of copies being made and transmitted through the network constantly. They see internet as a big photocopying machine. They see that emails are copied 10 times over from a sender to a receiver on the other side of the Atlantic. They see temporary copies in RAM. They see copies and copies everywhere being browsed, used, or transmitted. And that's a dangerous development, and in that respect, I agree totally with David Post. I think stretching the reproduction right is an extremely dangerous encroachment of freedom of expression and information on the internet. I have more to say, but I think my 5 minutes are over.
Well, thank you, Pam, for inviting me here as the only non-lawyer. I often find that defending copyright in situations like this is a bit like defending paedophilia. It seems copyright, to a lot of people, seems like an unnatural vice whose practitioners want to take something from the innocent and use it for themselves. So I think I should put my cards on the table that as an author, obviously, I do live by my rights. In the UK, I'm the chairman of an organization that collects money for authors from various uses like photocopying and cable retransmission and so on, and passes it on. And last year in the UK, we've distributed about £9 million, which we're proud of, but that is, in a way, that the conventional media and not the future. What we consider ourselves to be, in a way, is the commercial arm of authors. And I want to just have a look at that term, commercial arm. If you go back to the early days of copyright in the 18th century, there was a major battle over authors' rights. And nobody quite knew what copyright was, because it was expressed as a property right, but it was clearly an abstraction. And sometimes people said, well, it's the paper and ink, but that clearly didn't work. But if it's not physical, what is it as an abstract right? Well, this problem was solved, I think, as far as I understand it, by what you might call the commodification of writing. And copyright was turned, the expression of human ideas was essentially turned into something like onions, which could be bought and sold quite easily. And today, we are very definitely in a period where all cultural items are commodified. They can be bought and sold, and they can be quoted on the balance sheets of corporations as assets. And in the case of media companies, they're clearly the major assets. And this modern copyright system in which authors have to work is where we, as an organization in England, see ourselves cited. And but it is an a system which is dominated in the world by giant companies, very, very large interests, often multinational companies. If you look across the channel, you find a very different conception of what authors' rights are all about. And in some ways, this does, I think, have echoes in your constitution. This is the droit d'auteur theory of authors' rights, which is based on, essentially on the humanity of people. And in fact, it's based on their dignity and freedom as individuals, freedom from coercion. And in France, I think the copyright, the droit moral was instituted as one of the first legislative acts of the revolution. And one of the major points about the droit d'auteur system is that, in fact, economic rights are secondary to the moral rights. And now, moral rights are always something that I find Americans have tremendous problems with. I've never quite understood this. There seems to be morality is often discussed in America. It seems to me often misused as a term, but morality seems often to be bandied around. And so I've never quite understood why Americans should have so much problem with moral rights, but that they do. Moral rights are essentially the rights to be publicly acknowledged as the author and the right to prevent derogatory treatment of your work. But it's from these moral rights that your economic rights depend. However, I think that if we look at the roots of both systems, the copyright system and the droit d'auteur system, we find a common preoccupation. What is it that makes an author? What does originality mean? And how can the author's personality, the personality of a free human being, of an individual, how can that and the work be connected in some ways? And from that, then, socially, we wonder what rights an author should be given, given that an author is also a member of society, and like any other member of society, both contributes and takes. Now, this would be much easier, I think, to work out were it not for the commodification I talked about earlier. For if we go back even beyond the 18th century, back to the stationer's company in Britain, when stationers had a privilege from the king, we find that always the work of authors has been squeezed by the packages, the publishers, the producers, the booksellers, and so on. And this process of the packages against the authors, or the packages and the authors, has developed in today what we have is this very complex system. You may recently have read the extraordinary case of Joan Collins and her publisher. And of course, what that was about relative bargaining positions. And the publishers and Joan Collins were fighting over their bargaining position. Here in the United States, you've taken this process even further by inventing the notion of work for hire. Whereby actually authors, creators, are not encouraged by the to create so that they will have any property. They're just encouraged to create by putting money in their pockets. And that is something that I think in Britain we find somewhat objectionable. And I think this issue of freedom comes into it, because if you turn a creator just into an ordinary laborer, I don't think really the laborer has any freedom at all, because don't think that the work then belongs to the public. It doesn't. It belongs to the corporation that brought it, and that bought it, and that to me isn't freedom at all. I think this, therefore, is one of the crucial points at which copyright and freedom come together through this commodification of creation and the creator being increasingly shackled by the packages. And here copyright, which was once designed to aid the creator, and I suggest the public, the body politic, and I think, again, you have that in your constitution, is being used as a way to reduce, if not destroy, the independence of the human being as creator, the human freedom. And if you remember the Donne sonnet, he that where basically Donne says, if you reduce one human being, you reduce all. And so one of the things I do feel quite strongly about copyright is that at the root of copyright there is a force for democracy. But I'd also argue that copyright, in the way it could develop as huge corporate asset bases, could become a force that's opposed to democracy. And I'd like to return to that later in the context of the developing world. I just want to say one other thing, and I realize I may be going slightly over my time, but this is the issue of how copyright may be protected on the net. It's often said that in the future there'll be software to tie up everything, so nobody will be able to have a look at it unless they pay. And I'm told that over the last 18 months, the number of vendors that are either selling or proposing to sell copyright management systems has actually trebled, which is pretty extraordinary. 3 weeks ago, I was in Washington at the IMA conference, and there were more technology vendors in this area than you could shake a stick at. Now, the vision that some of these people are offering is I think, slightly scary. Imagine a bookshop. The first thing that happens when you go through the door is you have to show your passport. Then you're conducted to the shelves, which aren't open. They're actually covered in glass, and all you can read is the spines of the books. You want to select a book, so you point to it. Somebody removes it from the shelf, and then you have to show your passport again, and then your hand is stamped, and then you leave the bookshop. And not till you've left the bookshop can you actually see what you bought, apart from the spine of the book. Now, I think that's a fairly scary idea, but it's certainly one of the models that is being developed for copyright protection. Now, don't get me wrong, I believe that copyright does need to be protected, and I do think that authors need to be protected, but I think that if we move to that sort of that model where there is no look before you buy, it deeply worries me. But I don't think, so I don't really think that we can run a business in the future like that. But it does cut both ways. And I think that we can't go forward in a reasonable way if all we hear from the other side is that copyright is too difficult, or, to quote Nicholas Negroponte, copyright is a Gutenberg artifact and it's just basically got to be allowed to fall to bits before we can do anything about it. And to me, there is a question of trust here. But I think we also have to address the question of new models. And I'm very aware that the internet is a very different place depending on who you are. Is it a pornographer's haven? Is it a place for academics to exchange ideas? Is it a place where you can find out the latest news about movies? Or is it a public forum? Get half a dozen people in a room and they'll all give you a different view of where they've been. But this isn't surprising because cyberspace, that word again that everybody said we shouldn't use, is really a whole world. And just as the world contains different civilizations, so I think the net contains different civilizations. And I think the net contains groups of people who want to behave in different ways, and maybe it also enables you to behave in different ways at different times. Now, what I think we really have to beware of in the future with copyright on the net is the collapsing of these multiple worlds into a single vision of one world. Copyright actually is a world that contains many different species. Apart from the different jurisdictions, there are different implementations of copyright throughout the world, and as Bernd has just reminded me, we have an extraordinary series of library privileges in England, which is many of which are to do with preserving our national library, the British Library, as far as I can understand. Somebody said to me recently in Britain, there's no such thing as publishing anymore. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you can't talk about the publishing industry. It doesn't exist. There are lots of different types of publishing industry. There is anything from self-publishing to Simon and Schuster, and the same with movies. There's anything from small movies, and I was interested to see the piece in this month's Current Wired, to Jurassic Park. So I think we need a recognition that the world of copyright is an extremely complex area. It contains a number of different species. And if you kill off the system, you kill off the good, the bad, and the ugly. And just one final word before I finish. I don't personally believe, even though copyright is what does actually protect me and the people that I work with, I don't believe that copyright is ultimately sacrosanct. It's a system that's worked for a long time, and it's possible to keep it in operation for the present, I think, quite easily. But other systems are beginning to emerge. We've seen other ways of looking at this in Europe. One might say database directive is a new way of looking at things. I think that we have to be very aware in the copyright community that these new ways of looking at things will emerge, and not just demand that copyright stays as it is, but that it can develop, it can grow more arms and legs, and it may eventually look like something that we couldn't recognize today. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I wanted to start with a question about the policy documents that have been issuing in the United States and in Europe. I'd like to ask both David and Bernd to tell us about what the U.S. white paper on intellectual property in the NII and the European Green Paper about copyright and related rights in the information society have to say about this relationship between copyright policy and free expression values, and maybe that can help us get started with what they say, what they should have said, and what difference it would have meant if they had taken some of those issues a little bit farther.
Being one of the Europeans here, I think I should limit myself to the European policy paper. We have a European Green Paper, which was published last year, approximately July. And that was about the same time that your white paper was published. We are one round behind, basically, in Europe, where you had your green paper a year earlier than we had our green paper. You had your white paper when we had our green paper. Are we having a white paper? Good question. Things are going very rapid now on the international scene. You may have heard about the Berne Protocol. That's an annex. What's something heavier than an annex by now to the Berne Convention, which you all know about by now, even if you're American. The Berne Convention, big copyright convention that you never wanted to sign, and now that you did, suddenly you've become the most fanatic Berne Convention members we've ever encountered. I wish you had never did it. What's going on in what's not in Berne, actually, it's in Geneva. They're making this Berne Protocol, which originally would contain only a few rather boring subjects, such as computer software protection and so on, things that everybody agreed on anyway. But now they're putting in this digital agenda, mainly because of the pressure put on the international community by the United States. The funny thing is, at least we Europeans get the impression that what's happening now in Berne is being a rather complicated ruse of the United States government to get the national white paper initiative through the national legislation by using the international developments as an alibi. They can point at Berne and the Berne Protocol and say, well, we need that on the national level too. So now things are speeding up in Geneva, and if we're not very much mistaken, even this year, part of this Berne Protocol, including a digital agenda, including various new rights in respect of digital communication, might be adopted in a governmental diplomatic conference. Let me come back to your question. The question was, what does our European Green Paper say about free freedom of expression and information? Nothing. And that worries me.
let me try to answer from the American side, for it is, I guess, slightly ironic for Pam to be asking me what the white paper says. It's, as many of you know, she knows more about it than probably anybody in this room. And I recommend a piece that she wrote in the January Wired, which the title will give you some sense of the, what the white paper says. The title of her piece was The Copyright Grab. I think originally it was going to be called Tightening the Copyright Noose. Which was even too much even for Wired, I guess. The white paper, in fact, says a lot of the right things, the right things in the sense that it gives voice to some of the concerns we've been talking about, with the importance of free expression, the importance of fair use, the need for balance in copyright law, in order to ensure that the public good is served. It's not once, it can't be a one-sided question of protecting copyright owners. It says all those things and it does none of them. The white paper and the legislation that has been introduced on the basis of the white paper that is now pending in Congress, I think it is fair to say, takes the position that the net is a problem. The net is a problem because copying is so easy, and copyright owners are scared to go on the net because their valuable copyrighted material will simply be duplicated ad infinitum, and they will lose all control and all ability to get compensated for it. And the white paper sets out to solve this problem by making copyright law stronger fundamentally. I mean, this is a paraphrase and an oversimplification, but I honestly think it is a fair one. The legislative proposals will strengthen something called the right of transmission within the Copyright Act. It will make it actionable, a copyright violation, to transmit electronically copyrighted material, which is currently unclear under United States law. And in what I think is perhaps the more dangerous and troublesome provisions of the white paper and the legislation that has been introduced, there are a series of prohibitions against tampering with copyright protection schemes. I think Bernd mentioned a vision that some people have of the future of the net, involving technology that will package each byte out there, charge a fee for it, track its usage, track where it's moving, distribution, etc. The white paper, and the current legislation would make it a violation of the Copyright Act to do anything about that, to attempt to disable such schemes or to produce any devices or to offer any services, the primary purpose of which is to defeat schemes like that. I think if you're thinking about the threat to free expression or the clash between copyright law and free expression in a digital world, I would look there. Because I think it is setting, if enacted into law, at least on this side of the Atlantic, and again, as Bernd said, there's this curious dance going on whereby the U.S. copyright interests are going to Europe, making these proposals, coming back to the United States, say, gee, the proposals are already taking place, you know, in Europe. They're getting ahead of us. We have to join on for domestic purposes. If these proposals get enacted into law, I think that vision of the net, of a privatized world where people will not really have the tools to make use of information on other than the owner's terms, the copyright owner's terms, I think has a good chance of coming to pass. And that's a very different world. Again, good or bad, we can argue about, but what we can argue about is that is a very different world than the world we live in. That is going into the bookstore and having to pay to to browse through anything other than the title, or even the title, perhaps. So I think that clash is a very serious one that we all need to pay attention to.
Well, I could ask lots more questions, and I have them, but I did say that I would try to open the floor up to questions, comments, so if anyone wants to interject at this point, please feel free to do so. Just understand that at some point I may say, there's at least a couple of questions I want to make sure that get asked, so I might sort of slow us down at some point, but let's do take a couple of questions or comments now.
My name is Richard Threadgill. You sort of started to hint at it with the white paper, which is a truly terrifying document if you create intellectual property mechanisms, which I program occasionally, so I do. Can you talk for a little bit about the conflict between patent and copyright?
Wait, don't go away. Don't go away. I mean, what do you have in mind in terms of the conflict between
In the last few years, the U.S. software, specific pieces of the U.S. software industry have started to go to great lengths to try to contrive to perform software patenting, which is an attempt to do an end run around the fact that copyright protects expressions but not underlying ideas. It has always been held in U.S. court until very recently that you couldn't patent an algorithm. It's math. Learn to cope. And when you come down to it, you know, a lot of interesting new intellectual property is instructions for how to do things. Mm-hmm. And historically, as sort of craftspeople, we would like to say that, well, you know, what we care about is can you go do it and build it and can you make another one just like it? And you scale this onto the industrial model and you make lots of money, presumably. But if you're not someone who makes intellectual property of your own, you really want to make sure that you can keep making money off of the same gadget that somebody invented 5 days ago. Now, my own model of competitiveness says that we care a lot more about can we do it again next week from scratch than we care about did we build the cool gadget in the first place. But for me, creative expression is something I do pretty easily and pretty regularly, so creating every single bit that I've ever created isn't very important. Obviously, the U.S. Patent Office does not agree with me in this regard, unfortunately. And the Patent Office has been claiming greater and greater authority over what look a great deal like creative work.
Well, let me just a couple of comments about that. Not being a patent lawyer and patent law, there's an interesting sidelight here, I think. In the clash between copyright and patent, in a sense, is that patent law specialized very early, in a sense. It has its own priesthood, and if you don't know the right incantations, it is sometimes difficult to. So the patent law strikes a very different balance than copyright law does. Copyright is easy to get. One of the things that maybe everybody in this room knows this, but maybe not. People often ask me, you know, they say, "Gee, I've written something. You know, I wrote a poem or I wrote a song at home, and you know, and I want to get it copyrighted. What do I do?" And the answer is, you don't do anything. It's already copyrighted. Copyright is automatic. The moment you write down the song that you've written, you've got it. So it's very easy to get, and at least up to now, the deal has been, well, we're going to make it easy for you to get, and you have limited rights with respect to that information, precisely because it is so easy to get. Patent law is a very different deal with the public. It's very hard to get. And in fact, not only is it hard to get, you have to give up information to get a patent. You have to tell the public what your great idea is. In order to get the patent office, the state, to recognize this invention and to give you certain rights in it. Both of those balances, in a sense, have been moving in very complicated ways over the last few years. Copyrights are expanding in digital information, and that's been troubling on that side. And the ability to patent what was otherwise thought to be unpatentable has been expanding as well. I see it, you know, in the 16th century there was competition between different legal systems in England. The equity courts and the law courts were sort of fighting for customers. The copyright law and patent law, in a sense, have been fighting for customers too. In the early part of the computer revolution, copyright was winning because you could copyright code, you know, and you just had to write it down and it was copyrighted and it was easy and you didn't need lawyers. It was sort of magic. And I think recently that has shifted somewhat with the ease of availability of software patents. The consequences of that, I'll let Pam talk about. I mean, I don't really know what implications that has, to be honest.
Well, did you want to
talk about that?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm actually a patent barrister from the UK, so I can give a little background on this. Good. The position about software patents goes back to the last US Patent Act that came in. Basically, IBM did not want software patents. They said that because the same thing can be done in hardware as can be done in software. The old IBM 360, for those of you with the long memories, bits of it were in hardware and bits were in software that did exactly the same task. The faster versions were in hardware, the smaller bits in software. So we in Europe, when we saw this and saw the American Act going through, we said, right, we'll do the same. We will say that patents for software are not going to be allowed because it's simply like playing a game. It's rules. Of course, the industry changes. And the difficulty has come in that now all the people in the creative industry say, ah, yes, we now want software patents. And you can get a patent for software, and the way you do it is by saying you get a patent for the hardware, the special way of doing something. And then, of course, your patent can be infringed by doing the same thing in software. That's the approach that is taken in the legislature. The difficulty about all of this is that it is impossible, in my view, to do a proper patent search for prior art. Because you cannot search the libraries and all the material in the world until we have everything on one big internet. Because of that, the whole patent system is coming under extraordinary pressure. And things have been given patents, like the Compton multimedia patent, which should not have been given patents if they had had a proper review process. So as I see it, the patent system is becoming unworkable in regarding high technology areas such as this. Because what do you get with a patent? Well, you make a Faustian bargain with the state. You sell your soul, our wonderful idea, for this 20-year monopoly on Earth to have your work on hand. And it is associated with that, you tie it up with trademarks, so you are able to build your market share and push things forward in the future. There is talk in Europe of to have something a little bit smaller than that. That something bigger than a type of copyright protection, shorter in term than copyright protection, what is might be termed a petty patent system to deal with particularly innovative developments in these areas. The idea being to try and give people a little leap in these areas. You tried it over here with your look and feel litigation, which our views in Europe were this was a complete mistake. This was trying to close down thinking. And that is not right, but at the same time, if people make a substantial commercial investment in something, they should be rewarded. So that's the way that we're looking at things and the way things will roll forward.
Okay, thanks very much.
Good morning, Mark Goldstein, International Research Center. Two points and or points of discussion is, one, I'm not so scared of the digital bookstore. I think the publishers and the retailers will have to be smart and offer you more enticement than the spine of the book. I think in music we're seeing a model where you can download snippets or tracks or reviews or pictures of groups, and that they will, to draw you in, the virtual Borders or Bookstore or Simon & Schuster will themselves offer you much more than the titles at no cost in an attempt to entreat you to buy the full product or longer versions of it. But as a professional researcher, contract researcher, I have at any time 8 to 10 what I call transactional database provider accounts, Knight Ridder, LexisNexis, all sorts of people. It's very onerous, very expensive, very proprietary search systems, very difficult. And I personally look forward to a robust micropayment system that lets me get to databases I don't normally subscribe to, database services, and I see the potential for some more realization of, say, Ted Nelson and Vannevar Bush's vision of a Xanadu, or a kind of, I can annotate and point to a document within my writings, and for 8 cents or 3 cents or $2, you can go look at that original. And I guess I see some ability to build new dynamics in the micropayments and distribution models, even though the individual implementations in their nascent states may be scary, I think there's also a lot of realistic potential on the far end. And so if perhaps you could discuss within the micropayment schemes that more expanded vision of information access, it's not necessarily that you can get at that information without charging for it. People will want to be rewarded for that process, and the BME ASCAPs, your distribution model, has to be allowed to support those riders. So I in many ways look forward to the micropayment schemes.
Well, yeah, micropayments are in a way the goal of all this. And there are various payment systems available now using credit cards, but credit card transactions have to be over a certain limit, otherwise they're not financially viable. And once you get into the whole business of e-cash, of course, you get into huge problems, which maybe don't have much to do with copyright, but because they're linked to copyright, they are going to be problematic, because governments are going to feel that they can't control these anymore. And you get back to what we were talking about yesterday. How does the government control the net? Because at the moment we have, in Europe, a huge debate going on about a single currency for Europe. And I mean, I have a wallet stuffed with notes from different countries. And any time I can actually open a foreign exchange branch in my suitcase. By the way, I've got some Norwegian kroner if anybody's going to Norway. The thing with e-cash, of course, is it could become a single currency, but all it would need to do would for one national bank to back e-cash, and then you'd have a single currency. But of course, governments would worry about that, and particularly with anonymous payments, when they wouldn't be able to tell where the money was going and how it was churning and so on. So there are big conceptual problems with micropayment systems, and it's my belief that governments haven't really woken up to this. There are also huge tax problems. For instance, in France, there is a tax on books. There is no tax on books in England. So if you had a system whereby you could buy books in French in England, the French would be able to buy them in England and not pay any tax, and the French tax authorities might not like that. So one of the things that we haven't discussed really today about copyright and freedom is the whole issue of the national basis of copyright and the international basis of the net, and this is a huge issue, I think.
You know, I want to respond a little bit. I mean, I think it's a very good point that it's not necessarily a sort of a terrifying future to have some people who are charging for information as they think the best, and other people who are not. I think the challenge is to come up is to craft the balance, if you will, the copyright balance, so that those who want to charge for looking at the spine of the book do not interfere with those who don't. And that to me is what I think the future, I think could all agree on, is one where if at your bookstore, if you will, you have your charging mechanism in place and you say, you know, my authors are so well known that just giving you the title is all I'm going to give you for free. If you don't like that, go to another bookstore where they have different material, and that sort of diversity will shake itself out, if you will. And I'm perfectly comfortable with that. What worries me about, one word that I don't think has been mentioned yet is the word privacy. One of the concerns with this model, with giving the copyright owners all of the weapons, if you will, in designing this world is that they then get the tools in order to make that system work. They have to know, well, I've paid you the 2 cents for access to this article, but what have I done with that? Have I then surreptitiously sent it off to burn? And maybe we'll just keep track of that. And again, the white paper not only says they can keep track of that, but says really I can't do anything about it if you try to keep track of that. So I think your fundamental point is absolutely right. And the challenge is to design a copyright act that really preserves that balance and the diversity of different modes of business models on the net.
One of the things that I'll just interject that came up at this conference about electronic commerce in intellectual property products that the Interactive Multimedia Association sponsored recently was trying to persuade publishers to focus on protecting revenues, not bids. And some part of what you see with publishers who are used to printing and other kinds of the production of tangible objects moving into the digital environment is that they're so worried about the bits that sometimes they're talking so much about locking the bits up and not letting you have any access to it, so they're not thinking about what's in their real long-term best commercial interest. And so I think a good theme is protect revenues, not bits. And I think you're right that self-interest of publishers will often cause them to lighten up in terms of some of these things, but they are also talking very seriously about locking every piece of information up, making it a felony to tamper with any kind of license information which comes with a document, even if it's doing things like keeping track of what you're doing and what else is on your hard disk. And that's, it seems to me that that's troublesome. So we got to find a balance.
Hi, I am Rick Anderson from Reason Magazine. I think David Post is either being modest or negligent because he failed to mention that there's an interesting, excellent analysis of the Church of Scientology controversy that David wrote in the current issue of Reason, which was available yesterday, but all you good folks picked up all the copies. So we have, in a bit of shameless self-promotion here, we have two examples of the current model at work. You can either go to a newsstand and buy a copy for $2.95, if the copy with the spiffy cartoon comic book characters on the front, or you can get it from our website, www.reasonmag.com/reason.
All right.
My name is George Mokray, Information Ecology. I publish weekly on environment and telecommunications. And I think this is a small pond, but I think there are lessons in an even smaller pond, especially in terms of work for hire. The comic book community, the original multimedia, has been doing some very interesting things in terms of work for hire and revolt against that concept and independent distribution, sort of a kind of direct marketing system that the independent publishers, producers have put together. Dave Simmons, Cerebus up in Toronto is probably the person who knows most about this and most vocal. And I would suggest it would be interesting for this small pond to look at that puddle to see, especially in terms of work for hire, what's going on and what some other models may be. And I also think that the direct marketing system might have some relationship to what we're trying to do with the internet. I would also like to talk about a couple of examples. As with Reason Magazine, MIT Press has put up City of Bits, a full book on the net, and they say they've made more money because they have put it on the net. I believe the online bookstore had a deal with Stephen King and his publishers, and they published a series of chapters, and again, made more money because they gave people that. A third example is Thad Starner here at the Media Lab is a cyborg. He walks around with his headset on and his computer all the time. And in a lecture that he gave at the Media Lab, he talked about how he reads his science fiction. He scans the pages into his computer and he reads them off his eyepiece. Now, he may go to the science fiction library at MIT, take those books out and scan them and then put them in his computer. These are some interesting examples, some interesting real-life examples of how people are actually dealing with this technology today and the ramifications for copyright?
Well, can I just answer that? I mean, I'm very pleased to hear that there is a revolt against work for hire. But I think it also, what you've just said, absolutely underlines the point that what we have to do is preserve a plethora of models of publishing and creation on the net, because I think there is room for everything. And I just, what I would find totally objectionable is that if all the net became collapsed into one single monolithic model. And that, to me, is the danger of some of the legislation that's around at the moment, that it looks as though it could collapse into one model, like a sort of terrible, you know, collapsing star, and that the net would become a sort of frightening black hole from which there is no escape. And I think that what we have to really work very hard at is to try and preserve this myriad of models that is possible in this environment. Not say to publishers, to the megacorps, that you can't have your model, but just say, don't make your model our model or their model. And I think that's a really important both economic and political point.
John Eckhouse from Home PC Magazine. I have a question about the conflicts that can occur between the rights of individuals to own their own words on the net and the rights of journalists to fair use. Many journalists nowadays write about what goes on the net, and they will, with or without permission, often without, simply take a quota off of a posting. Someone may post 200-300 messages a week, someone else may post one in their life, but the journalist will take a quote. Sometimes they'll try to protect it by not using the name, but they will have the full content of the quotation there. Other times they will use a pseudonym. This came from a woman in Chicago talking about X. And then, of course, some of these will then be republished, whether in print or on the net. What are the rights and what of the individuals, and what are the obligations of the journalists?
It sounds like a case that's a very minor case that's playing right now in a very minor country, the Netherlands, about the internet baby. We had a couple, well, you have it in every country by now, meeting each other by a way of internet relay chat and then getting married and producing, in this case, one baby. The baby has been put on the internet, that is, photo, and you can hear its little heartbeat and a couple of other details. And then you can click on various body parts, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, all this on a website maintained by the proud parents. Then came a Yellow Precious type of publication. We don't really have a Yellow Press in the Netherlands, fortunately.
We have a lot of
them. I bet you have a lot of them. But this is the next best worst thing, that is. And they published a big article on sex on the internet. And amongst the many lewd sites that were described, many of them originating in Amsterdam, of course, which is the world center of pornography, as we all know, was this internet baby. And then the parents weren't happy at all. So the question arose, is there a quotation right from the internet? The court has not yet decided the case. My personal feeling is that if we want the internet to remain this world of free expression, we should not be too hysterical in respect of other media. That's one thing. I sometimes observe a certain tendency to within the internet community to be slightly hostile toward the older media in that respect, see them as commercially exploitative. That may be true, but even commercial exploiters have freedom of expression and therefore quotation rights in whatever legislation. You may call it fair use, we call it quotation rights. So in that respect, I would not be too restrictive of applying copyright law. That's not really an answer. Sorry.
But I think, I mean, it does point to the answer. I mean, at least in this country, and I think in Europe as well, I mean, news reporting does have a preferred place in the Copyright Act. Maybe it has to, by virtue of the First Amendment, we could argue about that. But, I mean, news reporting as fair use, the use of material for quotation and commentary in news reporting is given a special place. And most of the instances that I think you had in mind with the question would presumably be covered by the fair use privilege. One of the interesting things I think about the example is whether, I don't know, maybe some of you can enlighten me, I don't know of a case where someone whose material was initially posted, say, in a news group, and was subsequently quoted in, say, a news story, has complained on the basis of the Copyright Act of that. Maybe I just don't know of them. Maybe there are such cases. But it does seem to me that, again, that's a different case. Remember earlier I said, if we're out there in the hall and I'm just talking to you and you then quote me, we might have some legal questions arise, but it's probably not a copyright question. All of a sudden now these have all become copyright related. Taken it to court.
Uh-huh. But I think what is interesting about this is, of course, newspapers have ripped each other off for years. I mean, just in Britain, it's wonderful. You can listen to the BBC News at lunchtime, and if you've read The Guardian in the morning, you know what it's going to say, because that's the newspaper they all read. So this, actually, in the analog world, has been going on forever, and nobody's done anything about it. But the moment it goes all digital, everybody gets terribly protective. Right. And it's like the database directive, because a lawyer was saying to me in London the other day that one of his clients came to him and said, and this client had been previously saying to the lawyer, we really want the database directive, and suddenly realized that what they'd been doing, which is taking data from other people's stuff for years, they couldn't do.
Right.
So, I mean, there are these extraordinary paradoxes going on all the time at the moment because everything is so new.
Steve Jones, Crash Computing. Part of the reason or benefit of copyright has been the rights of the author, protecting the rights of the author and promoting the expression, and part of it has been the net benefit to society at large. Now, over the course of the century, in the U.S. at least, the length of copyright protection and its transition into public domain, and that whole concept, the length of copyright protection has been extended and extended, and either recently has been extended again or is up for it. I've seen or heard or informally heard plenty of discussion about how this plays into the commodification and work-for-hire aspects and, in essence, suppression or deleterious effects of the spread of that work or knowledge or what have you. I was wondering if anyone on the panel could try and speak to the position of those seeking to extend the protection as to what the other benefits are. Quite frankly, I haven't gotten it. And if there is an argument other than the right of the author to enjoy the fruits of that work or expression, is anyone making such an argument? What is it?
Well, I heard a very interesting argument for extending copyright terms when I was recently in Hollywood at a program sponsored by the Directors Guild. And the argument was that without copyright, there is insufficient incentive for any company to basically invest in the preservation of films. Because if you sort of preserve the film and make a big investment in it, and it's public domain stuff, then anyone can immediately copy the fixed up version, and you won't be able to recoup your investment. So, as a way of kind of protecting our heritage of national films, the notion is that it would be a benefit to have perpetual copyright. Actually, the thing to realize is that in the first stage of copyright history, copyrights were perpetual, and a printer would sign up to be the exclusive publisher of a work forever. And it wasn't until 1710 that there was a limitation on the duration of copyright, and now only sort of newly authored or relatively newly authored works could be protected. So in some measure, we're sort of creeping back toward a perpetual copyright. A friend of mine suggests that what we have with the current statute is kind of perpetual copyright on the installment plan, because about every 20 years, when Hollywood's copyrights are about to expire, all of a sudden it becomes necessary to extend the copyright term, and that's actually what's driving at the moment the domestic legislation in favor of extending copyright terms.
So, no, there's no better answer. There's no hidden argument that you may not have heard.
I think I'm more of a social idealist than most people in the room. I had been writing for 20 years without pay, which a lot of authoresses have to do. And I'm not motivated by money, but I'm motivated by, like, getting the ideas out and to try to change society to have some kind of justice. And I'm also an educator, and I was at the University of Massachusetts where I had a research account. And one day I was very inspired by some writing I saw on ClareNet, not realizing that it was a private paid group that the university has, because there was no way I could tell. And I took several of these articles about the women's conference happening in Beijing, and I posted them to my public news group, Alt Society and Utopia, and the university busted me. And they just went, it's definitely a technocracy, kind of some kind of dictatorship. I was not able to have any due process, explain to the chancellor what I had done. They did not know what Usenet was. So there was no way for me to even explain to them why they now considered me a criminal. And I tried to explain. I was working as an educator, and that is it. The author of the piece that, one of the pieces that I posted, was even saying, spread the word about what was happening in China. And that's exactly what I did. And for that reason, now they consider me a criminal. And I think it's really tragic when educators can't educate, and when we live in a system where there's still starving artists, and we can't create some kind of system that's a socialist system so that everyone can be creative.
A few words of a more general nature. This proves one of that there's problems not only in defining the scope of existing rights, but also in interpreting the internet, the implied internet license as we know it now, or as we don't really know it now. What do you really agree to when you put something on the net? Most internet users will probably not think of posting anything in a user group or in on any other kind of group as an implied license to do something with it, but that's the way we have to look at it from a copyright point of view. What we don't know is, what are we really allowing other people to do with it? Many people tend to think, like you did, that we are then free to circulate the same information, at least on within the digital environment, but we don't really know. This is one of the things that David just mentioned in his first intervention, that we should probably agree upon, that we should make norms for outside, preferably the courts and others that want to meddle with that.
Can I just like to say something? We're often asked by authors in the UK, what do I do if I want to put something on the net? And we always say, look, there is no method of protecting it at the moment. But if you want to put something on the net, if it's really valuable to you and you don't want it to be copied, well, don't put it there. But if you want to put it on the net on the basis that you want it spread around, as a header with the piece, or just give some information about, you may copy this, but I wish to have be acknowledged. You may copy this, but not change it, and so on. And we actually haven't talked about the issue of people manipulating other people's material in order to make a different sense or whatever. And these are extremely important issues. But I think it is incumbent upon anybody who puts material on the net to actually tell the next person the way they expect that piece to be treated. Because otherwise, it's very difficult for the next person to tell what they can do. And I think that that is very practical advice that you can give to anybody who posts something on the net. Just say to people, what can they do with it? Because actually, a lot of people, if they come across a piece saying, please leave it here, I don't want it copied elsewhere, or please take this but don't change it, actually most people will respect those wishes.
And I think also some sensitivity sometimes in situations where people didn't have a clear understanding, rather than being treated very, very harshly, it's sometimes a good idea to act more in an educational capacity. And so it may have been an unfortunate situation that was visited upon you out there in the way that it was handled. It seems to me that that part of sort of developing a kind of new netiquette about how to deal with materials that other people have authored is by developing some skills of communicating these expectations and maybe growing the netiquette. So that we don't have to rely on the law or to deal with all these problems.
Yeah, let me.
Well, people might disagree with you.
I think the issue of the sort of information haves and information have nots is one of those areas where there's not been very much exploration. Probably the single most insensitive sentence in the white paper on intellectual property in the NII was the one in which there was a plea against expansive interpretations of fair use on the theory that it would help the information have-nots. The sentence basically said that this should not be a tax on publishers to provide information to the information have-nots. It seems to me that that's a whole area that has not been given the kind of exploration that it needs. And I think your explanation of this is something that's going to happen again is probably right. I don't know that will in fact make things sort of better as a matter of policy, because wars of attrition of that sort, it seems to me, are not winnable by anybody. But let's move on to the next question.
Okay. Jim Settle, I think most of you know me in here, and most of you know that 7 months ago I thought this issue was important enough to the world to jump off the sidelines and into the blast furnace, so to speak. And a lot of interesting observations in a lot of the commercial customers I have. We heard Cheryl mention yesterday that their engineering documents had gotten posted up where anybody in the world could get them. Now, obviously, those are copyright. Look at Dow Chemical. Where do they keep their formulations for their products, their own computer systems somewhere? What happens when those get swiped and posted to the net? And that's what I thought was the real issue. Without getting into all the different things that went on, and we could talk forever, and a lot of what David Post said I would probably disagree with, but the issues out there, the scary things to me were when I saw what the courts were, how they were equipped to handle this issue, scared the hell out of me. I mean, literally, no, you had to check your computers at the door of the courthouse. There was not a computer anywhere in the courtroom. And you're sitting there saying, these people are deciding how you deal with the electronic world. One thing I would disagree with David on, I think in the U.S., the courts are starting to decide the copyright issues. And they are deciding that copyright applies to the net, now in different ways, i.e. the ISPs versus people who post it up. But we're seeing the courts make some decisions on there
which you may or may not agree with. But anyway, they're making decisions. We're seeing the U.S. Congress come in and start to try to pass laws. And our U.K. friend here mentioned, but we didn't get into, was the nationalistic trend to protect national interests, which leads me to the question, which is where, after all this process and everything we went through, here's what I see as the problem. We're going to define the U.S. law, and I want to throw this up to question. A huge percentage of the world has no intellectual property right laws whatsoever. As a matter of fact, the Far East could care less. We know that. Does the net, in effect, not wipe out everything the U.S. Congress wants to do, or the U.S. courts, or anybody in this room?
That's actually a good question to end on. I'm being given very clear signals that we get to answer this question and then must close. Who among our speakers would...
I'll start, and very briefly, I will start. That's a hard question to answer very briefly. The answer is yes and no. The answer is, is what the U.S. Congress does going to decide the future of information transmission on a global medium? No. Will what the U.S. Congress does have an impact on real people who are located in the United States and whose equipment is located in the United States and that can be seized under United States law and whose assets can be seized? Yes. Are they the right decision makers to answer these questions? I think the answer to that is no. I want to get back to the point Chris made, which I think is a very simple one, but a very important one about, putting information about what you can do with information when you send it out. In a sense, no one in this room knows what the expectations of the online communities are with respect to information and what the right copyright rule should be. The Congress doesn't know. I don't think the judges know. We're all, in a sense, muddling through and trying to figure that out. I think we are in a better position. We, in the sense of the participants in this community, are in a better position. We discredited some time ago the notion that the U.S. government or any other government could march into some area to make it safe and impose United States law to make it safe for United States businesses to operate, or the U.K. or whatever. I think something similar is happening. We have an obligation, in a sense, to try to answer that question from what we know about how these communities operate. It's a hard one to answer quickly. I'm sorry.
It's impossible. Somebody's very impatient.
Really?
I'm not going to answer your question, but going to correct it. There are, amazingly, by far the most countries in the world, even the very underdeveloped and very small and the very new, have copyright.
Right.
That doesn't answer your question, but... It actually makes your question even more complicated.
I would like also to make just one observation, and then I'm going to make one advertisement. But I'll be very quick. I have a friend who works at WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, and he is involved in helping developing countries implement their copyright legislation to accord with the TRIPS agreement. And he said to me when I talked to him about coming here, and I said, well, all the people are talking about the death of copyright. And he said, well, don't kill copyright, because actually for developing countries, copyright legislation is really important, because for the first time, they're going to be able to export intellectual property. And that is going to help those developing countries, because it's actually a comparatively cheap business to get going. That's the first thing. The advert is that Pam said that I'm involved with this Imprimatur project. We do have a website. The URL is, get a piece of paper out, please, www.imprimatur, that's imprimatur.alcs.co.uk, and it's in the brochure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You wouldn't have been able to do it without
Rick White is a Republican freshman congressman from the state of Washington. I think there's really no more appropriate person to come and talk to us about the Congressional Internet Caucus and about efforts to educate the Congress about the Internet, this medium that we all care so much about. Representative White worked very hard in the debate over the Communications Decency Act to find a solution to some of these issues that was somewhat more net savvy. As we all discussed last night, that unfortunately is now in the hands of the courts. But we're delighted to have you here, Congressman White, hear about your efforts, and we're looking forward to the work of your caucus and to working with you in the future. So let me turn it over to you. Please tell us what you're up to, and if you have time, I'm sure there will be some questions afterwards.
Well, thank you very much. Believe me, it's my pleasure to have the chance to talk to you all, and I thought I would just tell you a word or two about the Internet Caucus, because I have to say it was really born out of frustration that we all experienced in November and December when we were trying to get the Congress to do the right thing in connection with the Communications Decency Act. And I thought you might all be interested in a story that might bring it home to you, just exactly how this whole thing worked. We had, as I'm sure you know, there were two different telecommunications bills enacted by the House and the Senate. We had totally different approaches. In the House, our approach to regulating the Internet was basically to stay away from it as much as possible. And we didn't have any limitation on decency. We basically had something called the Cox-White and White approach, which basically said, let's encourage technology to solve this problem and otherwise stay away from it. The Senate took a much different approach, which basically said we should apply the sort of laws we have for broadcast television, which say that you're not allowed to broadcast certain things without a whole bunch of restrictions on it. And as we put together the committee to resolve the differences between the House and the Senate, it turns out that I was really the only one on the committee who was comfortable enough with the Internet, I guess, to fight the battle. So I found myself kind of completely by surprise being the person who had to try to find a compromise here between these two points of view. And we came up with a compromise that wasn't perfect, but I thought was a lot more friendly to the Internet and a lot more, would allow the Internet to prosper a lot more than the approach taken by the Senate. And we had a meeting of all the conference committees to try to convince people to adopt our solution. And just so you can kind of get the picture, this is a small room over in the Capitol that was absolutely packed. There were probably 25 or 30, actually closer to 40 members of Congress who were on this committee. Everybody had their two or three staff people hanging around them. And we basically had 15 minutes. I had 15 minutes to explain why I thought our approach made sense and to try to convince people to vote for it. And arguing on the other side was Henry Hyde, who is a very persuasive, a very conservative congressman from Illinois, saying that he thought the more restrictive approach was better. And we had this quick debate. Both sides got to express their point of view. We had a show of hands, and ultimately my side prevailed. Somebody suggested an amendment, and then within a flash of an eye or a wink of an eye, we ended up losing on the decency standard by one vote in this committee. And, as I kind of went back to my office after that meeting, it occurred to me that a lot of these people just didn't understand, that what we had essentially done is take a medium or a standard developed for broadcast television and apply it without thinking very hard to the Internet, which is a medium that is much, much different from broadcast television. I mean, it's one thing to have a standard when you have three networks broadcasting the same thing to everybody in the United States. It's much different when you have an interactive network where people can communicate with each other. That standard just doesn't work. And it was basically at that time that I realized that, we need to raise the level of awareness in Congress about what this new medium is about. And as I sat down and talked to people during that process, frankly, regardless of ideology, you could often persuade them that this was a different kind of medium if they had the time to think about it and maybe the time to look at a little laptop computer or something and see how it worked. But in the absence of that, people were really voting, I thought, without understanding what was going on. So, we fought the battles on the Telecommunication Act that ultimately got signed, and now it's in the courts. But we decided that in the future we're not going to get caught in this situation again, and that we need to lay some groundwork so that as these issues come up, issues of intellectual property and encryption and all the other things we're going to have to be dealing with here on the Internet in the next several years, we want to make sure that we raise the level of consciousness as high as possible in Congress so that we're not at least not voting out of total ignorance. We have to recognize that whenever Congress does anything, it votes out of a certain level of ignorance because these people aren't experts in every single thing they vote on. But it just occurred to me that if we could go out and educate members of Congress, we could hope to have a little better policy in the future. So that's why we kicked off the caucus yesterday. It consists of about 20 members of Congress, all of whom have had to take the online pledge. The online pledge says you have to be at least computer savvy enough to have a web page if you're going to be in this caucus. And you've also got to agree to participate in a little bit of a roadshow where you'll go and visit a couple of your colleagues and just spend 15 minutes playing around on the Internet with them to give them some level of awareness of what this new medium is about. And I think if we can accomplish that, we'll at least have laid the groundwork for some better policy in the future. Let's see. Having said that, you guys, I guess, can see the web page up there. It's still a work in progress, and we'd be delighted to have your suggestions and thoughts on how it can be approved. There's a response form. If you click on one of those icons about two-thirds of the way down on the right-hand side of the page, or the left-hand side of the page, love to hear your thoughts and comments. And frankly, we look forward to working with everybody in the Internet community to try to move this process forward. And having said that, I'd be delighted to hear what you guys have to say, to answer your questions, and or to receive any comments that you might have for me.
Congressman, thanks very much. We have several questions. We unfortunately have a slightly less than bidirectional interface here with the audience, so I'm going to ask people to pose their questions, and I'm going to have to relay them to you over the phone. The first question is from Brock Meeks from Wired Magazine. Go ahead, Brock.
Yeah, I'd like to ask the Congressman how he expects the Internet Caucus will be working with the administration, either Clinton or Dole, in the next 4 years, and how they see that working relationship and what impact and what type of relationship they expect to have with the White House.
Mr. Meeks' question is, how do you expect the caucus to be working with either the Clinton or Dole administration in the coming years, and what you see as the relationship between the Congressional Internet Caucus and the White House?
Well, I hope it'll be a good relationship. I mean, keep in mind, we made a kind of fundamental decision in putting together the caucus that we wanted both Republicans and Democrats involved, and both senators and members of the House. And when you make that decision, you've pretty much guaranteed that the members of the caucus aren't going to agree on every issue. There are going to be plenty of things that we disagree on. So we don't really see ourselves as advocating a particular position. We see ourselves as raising the awareness and raising the level of consciousness among, you know, members of Congress about the Internet. There's no reason that the Bush administration or the Clinton administration shouldn't be 100% behind that. The Dole administration. I guess we're not going back to George Bush. But there's
you've got to laugh at it.
Yeah, I have. But there's no reason that any administration really shouldn't be willing to work with us in that effort.
Next question is from Steve Levy from Newsweek magazine.
Two questions. First, does the representative believe that had Congress been more Internet savvy, the CDA would not have been included in the telecom bill?
The first question from Mr. Levy is, had the Congress been more Internet savvy, would the CDA not have been included as part of the telecom bill?
I think you would have seen a much different version of the CDA. You know, what we tried to come up with in terms of a compromise was a standard that was much clearer than the indecency standard, which we ultimately adopted. And I think you would have seen a lot more support, at least for that sort of solution to the problem. You know, we had suggested a standard known as the harmful to minors standard, which says, yes, there are some restrictions on what minors can have access to, but there are some very clear exceptions so that people know when they get into a chat room or when they put up their own web page or when they, you know, go online, that they know whether they're running afoul of any of these particular provisions or not. And I think, at least in the current environment of Congress, if there had been a little more awareness at the time we did the act, we would have been more receptive to that particular standard. You know, as I told people throughout this debate, we're kidding ourselves if we think the government can solve this problem. And I've got four kids. I've got a 12-year-old daughter who loves to get on the Internet. And there's plenty of things on there that I don't want her to see. But we can legislate until the cows come home, and it's not going to do us any good because our laws don't apply in Denmark or Thailand or Amsterdam or all the other places that you have access to under the Internet. So the ultimate solution to this problem can't come from the government. The only way a parent's going to be able to control what their child has access to is if they have software on their own computer, you know, that acts as some sort of screening device to make sure children don't have access to this. But you know, we've got a long way to go before we get the level of awareness in Congress up to that point.
We have one more question from Mr. Levy.
Yeah, currently there a lot of people in Congress seem to believe that by saying they can't program their VCR, they're forging some bond with the public, which isn't particularly techno-savvy. Does the representative think he could change that, or is there a danger, an instance of kind of partitioning off, you know, the people who are savvy into kind of a geek caucus that, you know, maybe don't represent the American people?
I'm going to paraphrase this question. Mr. Levy wants to know whether there's a danger that this becomes essentially the geek caucus, and that rather than educating the Congress as a whole and the American public as a whole, that we, the Internet community, and you, the Internet community and Congress, essentially build a wall around ourselves and isolate ourselves further.
Well, that would be a problem if I wasn't such a suave and sophisticated guy. That pretty much,
nothing personal.
No, I think the real answer to your question is, at least among members of Congress, the Internet is seen as anything but geeky. I mean, it's seen as the wave of the future, as something hot, as something sophisticated, something cool. And I think people really are, would like to get involved in it. It is true that the members of this caucus are people who have a particular interest in it, and so they probably do have a particular point of view in terms of promoting the Internet. But, you know, we're going to go out there and try to make this point of view very much mainstream. And I think we'll have some success in doing that.
Thanks.
Congressman, I think that we're out of time here. I'm sorry to the other questioners. Thank you so much for coming and talking with us. We're delighted to see your webpage. I'm going to give everyone the URL so they can have a look and poke around. The URL is http://www.house.gov/white/welcome.html. Sorry, I can't control the screen from here. We'll provide the URL again if people need it. Congressman, again, thank you so much. We all look forward to working with you in the Internet Caucus. We hope that perhaps next year we can have you and some of the other caucus members here in person to talk and meet with us.
We'd be delighted to participate. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Sure.